that's great. Reconvene, please. Thank you. We have a long agenda. We need to keep on track, please. So the next item on this morning's agenda is an opportunity for public comment on a petition for rulemaking. So no member of the public has signed up to make comment on that. So we will move directly along then to the next item, which is a petition for rulemaking from Ron Malley. And I believe there is a staff report by Mark.
Good morning again, Commissioner, members of the board. The board received a petition for rulemaking from Mr. Malley to amend WAC 222-24030 sub 9 to provide clear instructions on how to dispose of slash created when crossing a stream during road construction. Staff has reviewed this petition, and we found that Chapter 222-24, the roads chapter, and the forest practices rules, when collectively applied, do provide real clear instruction and direction for the removal and placement of slash. Specifically, and it's in your materials we sent to you, the chapter provides direction for the proper disposal and placement of spoils, debris, and slash that's found in 222-24010. For clearing debris from stream channels, that's in 222-24030 sub 5. Spoils and debris waste disposal in 222-24030 sub 9. And deposition of spoils and debris above 100 year flood level, which is in 222-24039 sub 9 sub 8. Also in chapter 22230, the timber harvesting chapter and the rules, direction is given for the proper removal and placement of slash and debris, specifically WAC 22230-100 sub 5 addresses removal of slash and debris from streams and replacement of slash in relation to timber harvesting. With these rules, the direction provided in these rules, staff recommends that the board deny Mr. Malley's request for rulemaking. Do you have any questions?
Yes, Carolyn.
Well, is it, I mean, I got your phrasing about collectively. And is there some thing with, you know, that could be sort of a tightening up so that somebody would be directed maybe through some of the materials about how to use the regulations and the manuals and everything, something to point out that there are, that it is there, but in different places, so that you know, future user of our work would you know, be directed.
There's no specific direction, however, the rules point out all of aspects of both road construction and timber harvesting. These are all in the same chapter of the rules, which is on road construction and maintenance. And in fact, parts of the same rule, actually when you read all of the subs, it gives clear direction. So it, his request would be to kind of put the full cookbook into one sub of one rule. That would be, the board could choose to do that, but that would be very repetitive. It would be language that's already contained elsewhere in that exact same chapter.
Dave? Mark, has this specific issue come up in the past, or how frequently does it come up if it has, in terms of the confusion that apparently has taken place?
From time to time, you know, landowners and operators find confusion in all aspects of the rules, but it's not frequent for this specific activity.
So it's not something that you have a lot of experience in terms of pointing to the need for a rule change. It's not that frequent.
Normally, when an individual is confused and and we talked to them. We always would point out all of the rules that would pertain to that activity. And for the most part, that is not a problem.
Yes, Paula?
So in this specific case, have you talked to the petitioner to make sure that the confusion's been cleared up?
Yes.
So we're being responsive, and can we as a board, I think Carolyn's question is, could either materials on the website or through board conferences illustrated, or just to make sure that the materials are presented in a clear way someplace, so the individual doesn't have a cause to, A, say we're being unresponsive, or and B, just to make sure that, we're presenting things in as clear a way as possible so these issues don't arise in the future.
We did have a dialogue via email with this individual. The petition was made after the dialogue. However, I believe a letter from the board explaining why the petition has been denied, accompanied by a copy of the illustrated and a full showing of all the rules that actually address this issue would be very helpful to that individual.
Any other questions, board members? I think staff is actually suggesting the path forward here.
Mr. Chair, I'd also like to point out that the region personnel, enforced practices personnel, also had more than one discussion with Mr. Malley about this issue.
Yes, sure.
Mark, isn't this pretty well documented in the Forest Practice Illustrated? It seems like a rule.
I believe it is.
Yeah, that's what I thought too.
That was sort of my question, but I didn't go pull it out and look at it for that topic. So.
I think it would be very appropriate to send a copy to Mr. Mallon. Mm-hmm.
So I sense that Mr. Malley is here. I'm sure of it now. However, are you unaware that there was an opportunity for you to sign up to make
yes,
comment
sir.
On this?
Yes, Mr. Commissioner, but it said that comments on the board actually referred later in the meeting.
Yeah, there was an opportunity provided just after the break relative to a sign-up over there for everybody. Everybody here, but I want to remind everyone that if you do want to comment, you do need to sign up on a sign-up sheet there so that we can know of your interest and provide you with that opportunity. Now, we will, Mr. McNally, do you have an interest in briefly addressing the board about this issue? Okay. So, with the board's approval, I will allow him. Go ahead, come forward, Ron, and we'll hear of your request directly. But please be mindful of the three-minute rule.
Yes, I agree with everything he said here. Except for one thing, is it doesn't say anything about slash. If you go down to construction, it says waste, debris, but it does not say slash. And there is a difference in the definitions, if you look in the definitions in the front of the book. And that's where it's coming from. And a slash that's produced going through the RMC, not the SIMD stream. As you build through, you're going to have slash. Where you put it, that's all I'm asking. It's just that you find where you put it. If you go to the harvest manual, the harvest section of it, you cannot cross the stream because it will not let you use anything that scarifies, compacts, or disturbs the soil. You remove slash. So it's actually got to be in the construction site. That's the second point.
All right, so any questions for the proponent here? Sherry?
Could you briefly describe the problem you're trying to solve? What have you seen in the woods that has been bothering you?
It's just that these are piles that were put in the right-of-way, in the RMZ from the right-of-way. And they say they can't be put there.
So, say that once more, please.
They state that the piles, the right-of-way slash, can't be left in the RMZ.
Okay. Do you have any other comments for the board?
I don't believe so.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
So, Mark, if you'd come back, please. So, hearing directly from Mr. McNally and his concern about the word slash and its meeting a different definition than debris, is there some straightforward way to correct that issue? Or do you think, or do you agree that that is a gap, so to speak, in the current rule?
Now, the current rule defines slash as pieces of woody material containing more than 3 cubic feet resulting from forest practices activities. For the most part, the debris generated through road construction would meet this definition. But it's, I wonder if there's debris also defined here. And I guess it'd be just a point of clarification. Debris, for the most part, would fit the volume requirement of slash, the 3 cubic feet.
So I don't want to belabor this point, but I think it's good the proponent was here and let us know specifically what it is. I remind the board that we have just gone through a work plan and we clearly talked about the need to keep rulemaking activity down. I think we all know that we want to be clear about what the rules actually refer to. I'm hearing from staff that, at least from a staff perspective, they feel that there's enough clarity in the current rules to address the proponent's concern. I just invite your comment and then perhaps an action or a resolution of the issue.
Just a quick question. If I'm just kind of thinking ahead, and with a question to you, Mark, during the RMAP rulemaking procedures that are kind of out in front of the board, they're not ready yet, but is there an opportunity, would that present an opportunity to make any changes, put them together?
If the board chooses, we could add a specific whack into that rulemaking, and it would then become part of that rulemaking, would be an addition. I believe that that's something, though, that would require, if it could be considered substantive, a substantive change, even though it's for a fairly minor issue, because it had not been brought forward during the 30-day review, so it may necessitate another 30-day review of the rules plus the addition of one more rule.
Go ahead. I appreciate that, because I don't think that's not what I would be looking to do, but is there anything that could be done short of a rule in terms of maybe clarifying forest practices, illustrated or board manual, or is there anything that's quicker and easier? I don't know.
There could be a language added to the board manual.
To clarify. This sort of vagueness about definition?
Right.
Slash and debris?
Yeah. Right.
So would that seem to resolve the issue from the board's standpoint? I would just suggest that I think it's probably inappropriate to consider rulemaking on something of this relatively minor nature, ordinarily, and even more so considering the situation now. So, do we need a motion?
We need a motion for the board. This is a petition for rulemaking. The board needs to either accept or deny the petition, and the motion would be in order.
Yes.
Commissioner, I will move that the petition for rulemaking be denied, but direct the staff to seek ways of clarifying the issue through the board manual or other means so that the issue is made clear.
A second?
Second.
Okay, thank you. We have a motion properly supported to deny the rulemaking and direct staff to resolve the issue through other means in the board meeting. Discussion on the motion. Call for a vote. All those in favor, raise your hand, please. Thank you. The vote is unanimous. Thank you, Mark, the proponent, for bringing this issue before us. And I thank the board for finding a relatively straightforward way to resolve it. Yes.
Just sure. One thing. Mark, if you go to 222-24030, number 9A, I think if you can clarify that in board manual, you will be able to meet what Mr. Ron is asking. Because it just says spoils or other debris, and somewhere in board manual you could define debris to include slash.
That would be the way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, thank you. Moving on then, the next item on this morning's agenda is water typing and a presentation from the Conservation Caucus on this issue. Good morning.
Good morning. Commissioner, members of the board.
Yes.
My name is Jamie Glasgow. I'm the Director of Science and Research for Wild Fish Conservancy. We're a member of the Conservation Caucus, nonprofit.
Hey, my name is Chris Mendoza. I'm a science representative for the Conservation Caucus.
I'm going to be talking to you about water typing for the next 15 or 20 minutes.
And thank you for that acknowledgement of your time. I know you have a significant PowerPoint, but please adhere to the 20 minutes.
We'll move quickly.
Thank you.
In fact, I think most of what I'm presenting should be familiar to all of you. It's a few of the specifics that we'll really drill down to. This is the water typing process or system as defined in WAC 222-16-030 and 031. As you should recognize, type S, shorelines, F, fish bearing, type N, non-fish bearing, and type U, unclassified. And this classification system really just identifies the distribution of fish and fish habitats so that appropriate buffers can be placed on streams to protect those fish and fish habitats. Unfortunately, that's not always happening. Even in this day and age, are many examples of where streams are incorrectly classified and do not receive the buffer protection that they are supposed to under existing regulations. This is what a typical water typing map looks like, or one way to present it. You can see the watershed. This is McLean Creek, as an example, and just down the road from here. The watershed's broken into distinct reaches, and each reach receives a classification based on the presence of fish or the presence of fish habitat, physical criteria defined in the WAC. What you may or may not realize is that these maps that are maintained by the State Department of Natural Resources have significant implications outside of forest practices. Most local governments refer back to these maps and incorporate them into their critical area ordinances through the Growth Management Act. And so the accuracy of these maps have implications not only for forest practices, but for management of stream and wetland habitats outside of forest practices. This is not something that DNR asked for, but it is something that has landed in the laps of DNR. The problem, of course, is that the DNR maps that guide stream protection are inaccurate. They frequently underestimate the distribution, typically the upstream extent, of fish and fish habitats, and many of the streams are incorrectly mapped or are not on the maps at all. Consequently, many misidentified fish habitats are not receiving the protection they warrant under existing regulations. I want to emphasize that we're not talking about new regulations to provide more protection to streams. We're talking about the existing regulations that were developed to protect streams, which would be adequate if the maps that drive the implementation of those regulations were more accurate or more consistently ground truthed. Just a quick example here of those two types of errors that we frequently encounter when we're doing surveys on the ground. The upper map is from the Department of Natural Resources. The bottom is a ground truth map. And to show examples of the two types of errors, we have a stream reach in the circle here, which the DNR maps told us were predicted the absence of fish or fish habitat, and we in fact find fish. And the other type of example, a watershed that exists on the ground that does not exist at all on the official water type maps. So we've been doing these systematic water type assessments throughout much of Western Washington. These are projects that are funded in large part through the Salmon Recovery Funding Board, who has recognized the need for this important on-the-ground work. These are areas where we've performed surveys. I'm going to show you a couple more examples just to demonstrate the magnitude and the extent of the discrepancies between what we're told to expect from the DNR maps and what we actually find on the ground. Again, a local example here on Cooper Point, just to the northwest of downtown Olympia. On the left, we see DNR's map. On the right, the ground truthed map. And to put some numbers to it, we see significant increases in the overall stream length, as well as the length of fish-bearing and non-fish-bearing miles. To look at this issue at a different scale, just one small watershed on Cooper Point, here on the northwest side. Again, on the left, DNR's water type map and the ground truth map that we were able to create after doing an on-the-ground survey. Even before we get on the ground, I think you'll see when we use this digital elevation model that's generated from LIDAR, which we'll be talking about a little bit in the future, shows the valleys where the stream channels are likely to be. So even before we get on the ground looking at this watershed, we know that there's going to be a larger watershed there. We don't know exactly how large or where the distribution of fish and fish habitats will be. That's why when we do on-the-ground surveys, we can document using GPS exactly what exists where the fish and fish habitats are. Again, putting some numbers to these images, we see some, again, significant improvement in the accuracy of these maps. Here in Mason County, this is an ongoing project. To date, we've covered about 30,000 acres, comprising 56 watersheds, about 112 miles of stream, and we're, as a quick summary, we have so far have found about 6 miles of streams that exist on the ground that were not at all on the state's water type maps. Northeast Kitsap County, this is Miller Bay area just outside of Squamish. The points on the map represent locations where we've collected GPS data. Looking at one example here, Cowling Creek. Looking at the DNR map before the survey, during the course of the survey, the locations where we GPSed points and the actual distribution of water and channels within this watershed. Again, pretty staggering discrepancies between what the maps tell us to expect and what we find on the ground. In this case, the DNR maps missed about 2/3 of this watershed. And everything I've said, I suspect, it doesn't come as a complete surprise. The state has long acknowledged that these DNR maps are to be used as a starting point for on-the-ground surveys, and that it is the responsibility of landowners to ground truth these maps before relying on the information presented in the maps. However, there are numerous examples of when that doesn't happen, and some significant implications for when that doesn't happen, what the consequences are for that particular stream reach, and actually for that reach downstream to the mouth of the stream, not just the reach itself. We see impacts on the hydrograph, impacts on erosion, impacts on water temperatures, and impacts on water quality when riparian quarters do not receive the protection that they warrant under existing regulations. And again, just to reemphasize, the rules are in place to protect riparian habitats, but it's not happening as consistently as it needs to be. And until that consistency is reached, mistyping, in our opinion and our experience, may be the single biggest factor that contributes to the loss of riparian habitat under the current rules.
Commissioner, can I ask the question?
Yes.
Was that last frame of non-fish seasonal type?
I'm sorry?
Was that typed in a non-fish?
That was typed as a non-fish.
Seasonal?
Yes.
Okay. So we could have had a major storm event or something like that when you went out to take these pictures of that stream.
It's certainly possible, but as you maybe can see in the picture, we had an ID team meeting, and DNR, the regional office in this case, agreed that this should have been typed as F.
Was a water type modification form used for that typing then?
No. This landowner had it.
Some of the problems with the current system we have.
Excellent segue.
Thank you, Sherry,
for leading into the next
slideshow here. I'm going to shed some light on that subject. These next few slides are taken from the compliance monitor report, this last biennium, the one that you got in your packet. So they're ten of these to look at not just the information that Jamie presented, and that she did an excellent job of some of the problems with the maps, but the compliance monitoring crews actually found similar discrepancies when it comes down to landowners. Some landowners, I'll make that distinction, not leaving type F buffers on streams without type F characteristics. So this one, if you read it, says type F physicals or fish being present in type NP waters. So that's non-fish bearing perennial waters 24% of the time. So in the first column, it says number sampled, NP's 89. And then the far right column, NP to F, that simply means they were buffers, NP buffers, not fish bearing buffers, left on streams that had type F fish bearing characteristics roughly 24% of the time, about 0.25%, which we think is pretty high considering that the flip side to that, which is how many type F channels, that is fish bearing channels, have non-fish characteristics. Well, according to the compliance monitoring report, of the 121 type F or S sampled, the second column from the left, F to NP, that simply means fish channels that have non-fish characteristics, 3. So that's 2% of the time. So clearly we have a discrepancy here. It's one way where you have the model that's showing more channels as non-fish that actually have fish channel characteristics. And we want to thank the compliance monitoring crews for filling out those worksheets. This is another part of the compliance monitoring report that I spoke to earlier that just shows of all landowners for type F waters, compliance rates on type F streams are low for no inter zone at 60%, no entry RMZ at 57%, DFC option 1, which is thin from below, is 50%, DFC option 2, which is leave trees closest to the stream, also known as pack and whack, 80%, which is good. The point being that, you know, even when we get fish buffers left on fish streams, we still got some work left with compliance. However, the first step preceding that is to make sure you get the right buffer on the right stream. And that's kind of what we're shooting for here. So this is taken off the DNR website. We're kind of moving on to the language here that Jamie spoke to earlier. So when you go to the website, it clearly states, as Jamie pointed out, that landowners are required to correctly identify and type all waters within the proposed area, harvest unit boundary, or 200 feet. But then below that, you have a language that states, quote, landowners or others may voluntarily submit a water type modification form, and that landowners are encouraged to submit these forms, as it's the only way that water typing locations and updates can be made to FPAR. So here you have sort of a diaposing language where they're required to do one thing, but they encourage to do another, to update it on the map. I've got a kindergartner at home, and I encourage her to clean her room, but it doesn't happen all the time. She's got a sister in college, and she's required to register for classes, or she gets kicked out of school, and it gets done. So I think the point here is being that if you require something to be done, it's usually going to happen. If you encourage it, likely not. So some of our recommendations here we think are simple fixes that could help improve compliance rates. And one is that the water type modification forms, you can make them mandatory, not voluntary. In other words, if landowners are required to go out and measure those characteristics, in other words, actually run a tape out, measure channel gradient and clino, and the next step would be simply document it, put it down on a piece of paper. For all water types, not just if you're trying to downgrade from an F to an non-fish. Second bullet is helping enforcement would help with water typing under the current WAC. DNR's compliance monitoring program actually shifted some funds to ecology a couple years ago in hopes of trying to nip this at the front end. In other words, ensuring that landowners were getting the water type right before they actually harvested. However, those successes aren't borne out by the compliance monitoring data. So we're less confident that is having an effect of improving compliance. A couple other recommendations would be restoring the scenarios that used to be on DNR's website, water typing scenarios on how landowners go about water typing once they get a map. The old scenarios that were removed were, unrealistic for one, and they didn't happen very often for two. So we'd like to see those restored with more realistic versions. Second, you could have a certify that they're not relying on the maps would be another recommendation via a form. The use of LIDAR as a screening tool. Everyone that's seen LIDAR knows that it's superior to any other tool when it comes to identifying and locating streams on the ground and unstable slopes. So LIDAR is a great technology that we hope everyone can embrace. And the last one is just to get policy to reprioritize water typing on their task list. It's been on the list. It was up high on the list after DFC, but policy's busy and other things come along and bump things out of the way. But we think that they could pick that ball up again, essentially, and help define the extent of fish habitat and octopus fish presence, which is part of the HCP, and develop board manual guidance accordingly. Lastly, we'd like to acknowledge DNR, Fish and Wildlife Ecology, and the tribal nations that participated in collecting the compliance monitoring data. And we'd also like to thank those landowners that are spending the time and effort to ensure that water typing is being done correctly on their lands, which is the 3/4 of those that are. Question?
All right. Thank you for that presentation. Are there questions from board members? Stephen?
So, can I have lights, please?
Yeah, we're working on it.
Thank you. I want to be able to look back at their recommendations. And one of the things I want to comment on is a little bit of our history / baggage from the past. DNR received funds to model where we expect to see fish habitat and did that modeling. And updated their maps with that information. The last time we addressed this issue and policy was not able to bring a recommendation to the board made a decision to keep the interim water typing rule as it is. I want to make sure that we separate the issue of not having all streams on maps because Forest and Fish partners never expected to get that out of the process. They wanted to focus on figuring out where fish-bearing waters were best predicted instead. Our neighbor to the south spent millions and millions and millions of dollars in the mid-90s mapping all their streams. And we thought that this would be a better process as far as bringing around for the fish and the fish. But I'm struck by the results, and I guess I'd like to know more about your sample, because are these focused on coastal streams, or is this, would you expect to see these results statewide if it was expanded to see that? Because when we last dealt with this issue, both as board and the policy group, the impression we got is the modeling of the DNR maps was overestimating fish-bearing waters, and that's why landowners did a lot of surveys and continue to do a lot of surveys. So this tells me a totally different story. So can you, is this just a result of a certain characteristic or geographic nature of streams?
Well, yeah, I can answer that. First of all, the geographic distribution of the sample would be known by DNR. Remember, this is compliance monitoring data. So it's the crews, these were taken right out of the report. So I don't know the specifics of where all those water type forms came from. But regarding the model and its level of accuracy, having spent time on ISAG, the Stream Scientific Advisory Group, which headed up that model with others, its level actually varies depending on the landfall. Remember, when you develop a model, you plug a bunch of things into it. In this case, it was basin area, channel gradient, precipitation, and elevation. I think those are the four drivers. I think Brian Francis, correct me if I'm wrong, but he was also on ISAC. So depending on how you tweak those input variables, you're going to get varying levels of accuracy. So in this case, in my opinion, one of the biggest limitations was using a 10-meter DEM, which is not very accurate when it comes down to looking at channel gradient. And that if you have a landform like the North Cascades, where you go from subtle topography to very steep, then you're probably going to see that, and the model might be more accurate in those cases because you've got obvious transitions in channel gradient that even 10 meters a year can pick up. Conversely, you could look in areas of moderate to low topography where that might not be work as well. Where LIDAR, for instance, I think Jamie had some great pictures up there of LIDAR, where the topography is much more pronounced through LIDAR. So to answer your question, it's all over the map. And while there may be cases where the model maps put fish habitat in areas that aren't, there's also many cases where it does the reverse of that. In other words, it puts fish habitat, as types it out as type NP. And lastly, to me, it's secondary to the issue of what the WAC says. Because the WAC is the rule, and that's what drives what's on the ground. And the WAC 031 is pretty clear, 222.16.031. It says, landowner, if your channel looks like it has fish, in other words, it meets these characteristics, you treat it as such and leave the buffer, or you hire someone to do a protocol survey. That's the choice. So the burden's on the landowner to make a choice there. They don't have to do a protocol survey, but if they don't, they should leave the buffer. If they do, great, they can do the survey and find out whether there's habitat or not. And so what these results display is that on those N channels that had F characteristics, there was no protocol survey. In other words, they made the choice not to do that. But the map was wrong. It had fish channel characteristics in those cases. Does that answer your question?
I'll hold. You have a question?
Well, it kind of goes to the heart of what you were just saying, and a couple of your proposed recommendations. You know, one is to have landowners submit a form regardless of if they're asking for a retyping. Is that correct?
If the typing on the ground is inconsistent with what's on the map.
Right. So just focusing on that recommendation, do you think that would go a long way towards fixing this issue?
It may. It couldn't hurt. I think that if you're going through the trouble actually measuring those characteristics, what's the extra step in writing it down? And then you have a document. So if DNR comes along with their compliance, they can go out and say, okay, landowner X measured the channel, and here's what they found. And then they can go out and compare what they find against that. If there's nothing on paper, it's just unknown what was done. Even though they're required to validate those maps, there's no documentation.
I think taking that extra step provides a little bit of accountability that seems to be missing right now. That could lead, I think, to some real improvements in how water type is implemented.
Thank you.
Other questions from board members?
Hello.
Mr. Summers?
Thank you. I'm not familiar with the scenarios. Could you describe this a little bit more and how they would help?
Yeah, I mean, initially DNR, when the maps were rolled out as not ruled because they didn't meet the 95% accuracy, which is what was the threshold for 030 to adopt it, didn't meet that, so the board couldn't adopt it. But they rolled the maps out anyway because they were basically an improvement on the old hydro layer. In doing so, to try to get landowners up to speed on how to use them, they had several depictions on their website of water typing scenarios, and they were just that. If you get this map and it looks like this, then this is how you should proceed. And those scenarios, there was, we had a lot of issues with them because we thought they were unrealistic, and they didn't actually represent the majority of what you did find on the ground. And rather than correct for them, they were removed. So there's nothing on the website under those scenarios anymore.
So you think they're correct?
We think, not only correctable, we think they'd be very helpful. Because if you put the right scenarios up, the most common ones, based on a lot of the water type that I've done, including me and others, that in fact would provide guidance to landowners to help them understand how to proceed with those maps, particularly when they're inaccurate.
Other questions? Sharon.
Chris, I think you're portraying a story that isn't always necessarily true in the field. I mean, most folks do not take the maps as the word, you know, because of knowing of the inaccuracies that we've all looked at over the years. And they do physical characteristics. It was 2 feet wider, that's a fish-bearing stream, plain and simple. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to get that one figured out. And from what I see in the field, physical characteristics is the determinant, not the map. And what irritates me the most about this is that 10 years later, we're still under an interim rule. We never got to where we needed to go to have fair typing for fish-bearing streams. And that's very frustrating, isn't it?
I would agree with you, Sherry, that on both counts. One is, remember the flip side, that type N non-fish streams being mistyped 24% of the time is that 76% of the time it's as you say. And that's, you know, I agree with you. But we think that a quarter, missing them a quarter of the time, given the number of streams out there, is a pretty high rate.
But when you look at the compliance report, activities in the RMZ, there's 76 compliant, 4 that were minor. So basically, you had 91% of harvest activities in the RMZ that were either compliant or a minor infraction. And we know what those minor things were. They were pretty doggone minor. So 91% to me is not bad at all.
Yeah, I provided compliance filing comments earlier, so I won't respond to that. But your last statement, I agree with it. Defining fish habitat that was left to the side after the interim rule decided to continue is unresolved. It would be good to get that done. I agree with you there.
Norm?
Yeah, having read the letters and heard the report, now I'm still struggling to understand exactly where. What the problem is, as a landowner, I know that we are required to identify all waters on our forest practices application. And that is on the maps. It's within the documentation. Here's the FPA and all of its instructions. That is a requirement. And we have a couple of opportunities there. We can submit a water type modification form. That doesn't mean we get to change the water type. That's not our responsibility. That's a DNR responsibility. We can provide evidence, but that modification has to be approved by the department. Again, it's not something that we get to make the decision on. All we can do is provide the report. If we don't do that, we have a water type classification worksheet right here. It's within the instructions. It's within the FPA form. For every stream out there, we go through a checklist that says, is it wider than this? Is it more than this gradient, et cetera, all the way down to come up with evidence that we've looked at every stream out there on our FPA. So the system is in place. Now, I know that there is some time lag in water type app modification form information being decided within the department and then updated on maps. I mean, that's a simple fact of administration that some of those delays occur. We would love it to be faster, so would everybody. But you know, we've made good progress in that, where those modifications have actually become part of our map base. And then last comment I would make is to not jump to conclusions regarding the 24%, I think it was, that Mr. Mendoza referred to. And reading from the compliance monitoring report, if you want to see it, it's page 8. Although the compliance monitoring team may observe what appear to be differences in a stream type, the observations cannot be used as a basis for reclassifying water types for two reasons. They have a limited length of the stream or water body that they are observing, and there may be a prior accepted protocol survey of which the team is not apprised. We should not jump to conclusions that because the report said there were 24 that could have been fish, there were actually 24% that were fish.
Yeah, we'll get another chance to talk about this when we talk about the compliance report.
Yes, but since it was brought up specifically in this recommendation as being right. cause for alarm, I think that we need to point out that it may not be the appropriate conclusion.
Other questions?
Yes, just a question. We just went through some water typing on our own property not too long ago, and a question with that, a little bit like Steve did, we found more streams were over-typed than under-typed in this case, and then I'm speaking for Lewis County, so I do kind of question where your data comes from. I don't, because it's been my experience that I've seen as many that are over-typed as I do under-typed, so, you know, I don't. You made it seem very, very lopsided in your presentation. And my experience is this and that. What it goes both ways. And I agree that they should be typed correctly. But I think it's important also to know that it does go both ways.
Well, the data that you're referring to is DNR's compliance monitoring data. So those first two slides, it's not my data. It's the state when they went out and did compliance monitoring, and that's taken directly from the report. And so those results suggest otherwise, that there were only 2% of type F channels that had non-fish characteristics, as opposed to 24%.
But in all fairness here, I think there are different stories embedded in all the data. There are stories where it's typed wrong in one direction, and there are stories where it's typed wrong in another direction. I think in fairness, you've showed us some fairly extreme examples where it's typed incorrectly, where there is fish bearing, where it's classed otherwise. So I think we as a board need to listen carefully to all the data. And I would just encourage us to move forward, and we're not here to sort of debate this issue right now. Hopefully we can do this just a little later in the meeting when we discuss the compliance report, which looks at the entire data set not just at limited snapshots.
If I could quickly then just defend our data. We do see errors in both directions, and we report what we see. There's a lot of information, including interactive maps showing where we've looked and what we've found, including photographs of the habitat and the fish we've brought to hand on our website, which is wildfishconservancy.org. We do work throughout Western Washington, and different regions do have different results. The San Juans, for whatever reason, the modeled maps are incredibly accurate there. And almost everywhere else that we've worked, we're seeing results along the lines of what I've presented. Significant underestimation of the upstream extent of fish habitat and a lot of streams on the ground that are not on the DNR maps at all. Again, you see where we're doing the work. It's lowland, as we've mentioned. The topography has a lot to do with the accuracy of the map, especially when you're building it using a 10-meter digital elevation model. I think there's a lot that can be gained by using better data that are available now, including LIDAR, and requiring a little more accountability, a little more detail along the lines of that worksheet that is in some FPA that does not seem to be required consistently across the board. There, I think, are some real opportunities to improve the protection of riparian habitat under existing regulations.
All right, thank you. One last question, Carol.
Okay. I was not listening to the presentation. One thing that I kept thinking about was the point that Sherry made, was the fact that we're still in an interim status after 10 years, that fact that escaped me until you brought that to my attention, and that, you know, that working in these contexts, that we need to do everything we can to have the best data sets, the best technologies and so forth that we can use. And so that's what I keep coming back to, that there's some needs in the system to make sure that we can have some level of trust or a fuller level of trust in all these, as many of these situations are perfect. But, and so it just feels to me that we need to focus on that. You know, I don't know if a certification process is a way to sort of close a loophole or close a thing that could be a problem, depending on what happens as people try to interpret in the field and stuff. But it does seem like if we could just bring back to our attention the need to move beyond the general stats and see what it would take to improve the situation for everybody in the field. That's what I'm trying to do.
So if I could suggest, you might bring that up again at our last agenda item today. So thank you both for your presentation. We appreciate the time and effort and the information you provided.
Thank you.
Moving on to the next item on today's agenda is an issue under Board Manual Section 21 Low Impact Template. Invite Phil Hess and Ken Miller to come forward, please. Good morning, guys.
Good morning. Good morning, Commissioner Goldmark and members of the board. For the record, I'm Ken Miller on the Small Landowner Advisory Committee. And my partner in crime here is Phil Hess, the chair of the Small Landowner Advisory Committee. We're going to kind of share this role here today, so you see us kicking each other under the table. It'll be because it's the other guy's turn here. So, but we thank you very much for the opportunity to update the Forest Practice Board on a work in progress. Peter Goldman in the back room, back of the room, Smalls are frequently accused of whining at the board all the time. So that's something I think we both resent and probably resemble.
We're not going to let you down.
But because of that, it's appropriate to acknowledge a memo that came from the Forest and Fish Policy to the board regarding the accomplishments that have been made over the years for smalls. We do appreciate those, and we especially appreciate the commissioner's help with FREP, trying to keep it alive and
get it, ultimately get it funding. So we don't want to sound like we're not appreciative of everything else that goes on. But I think our continued whining or persistence, if you will, is really based on the deals that were made originally in Forest and Fish, and Phil will highlight some of those.
Well, I don't know if you've all had a chance to read the proposed template. I don't, and we certainly don't expect you to, but if you want to look in the back, in one of the appendix, there's a complete list of the RCWs and WACs that what we refer to as the promises to small forest landowners and forest and fish. And we're just going to briefly highlight a portion of those that we think are most relevant for you to be reminded of. And I also want to mention that these have strengthened our resolve and our motivation for proceeding with these, with this template. And I'll paraphrase some of these, so I'm not going to read them all. The legislature intended that small forest landowners have access to alternate plans or alternate harvest restrictions, or both if necessary, to meet public resource protection standards, but which also lowers the overall cost of regulation to smalls, including but not limited to timber values foregone, layout costs, and operating costs. Also, of particular relevance is the legislation recognizes that forest practices rules will impose substantial financial burdens on smalls, which, if not partially offset through other changes in laws and rules governing forestry, could lead to deterioration in the quality, condition, and amounts of forest on those lands, and long-term adverse effects on fish and wildlife habitat and other environmental amenities that those lands provide. This legislation was recognized by the board a while back. In their statement, the board reaffirms its commitment to enable small forest landowners to successfully implement all components of the forest and fish rule package. By the way, that was May 17th, 2001. We don't believe we're there yet. The board did recognize in rulemaking and clarified, in our view, that riparian functions will be evaluated on a landscape scale versus individual stream segments. The rules provide for the treatment of riparian forests while maintaining minimum acceptable levels of function on a landscape scale. That's an important point when you review the proposed template.
So just to update you on the process to date, Phil and I have been working on this off and on for well over a year. We first floated the idea of another way of looking at the templates at a small forest landowner advisory committee meeting in October, and we were welcomed and encouraged by the state caucus, at least with the initial concepts that we tossed out. So we went to work and finalized a little more of the draft and submitted it in late November. We had a very well-attended small forest landowner advisory committee meeting in December. We spent all day, part of the day, kind of explaining the template so everybody had a clear understanding of it. And then Mary McDonald collected a list of concerns. We continued working with individual caucuses and went to the Forest and Fish Policy Group. Here's kind of my working list of everybody. I think everybody in this room has gotten at least one copy of it. We worked real hard at trying to get a lot of exposure on it so we could kind of move along. Then towards the end of December, we took the concerns that we had at that date and did our best to address all of them in the draft that's before you now. we hoped that everybody would just automatically sign off on the thing and we'd be done with it, but of course that didn't happen. I don't know what's holding it up or who's holding it up, but seriously, we do know that the state caucus is working very hard on it. They've been having regular meetings, and we look forward to getting a response from them and seeing if there is a joint path forward. So we're at this point, we're encouraged. As I mentioned, Phil and I started working on this well over a year ago after having been beat up or given up trying to move the state caucus, move the metrics on different rules to try to accommodate us. And we said, well, let's try a different approach here. Maybe if we just take all the things that are already approved out there in some fashion or another and put them into a template, maybe there'll be a little more opportunity for success. And maybe we can still shape those into something that will work for smalls. We're not going to get into the metrics today at all, but we chose to stay with the existing RMZs for the west side and east side, with the exception of some reductions if there's no summer water, and buffer increases on perennial water, something that we can see on the landscape pretty easily. At a core of the template is active management of the RMZs, using a combination of thinning, kind of around the overstock stand template that's already there, and small, less than an acre in most cases, patch cuts, and from our viewpoint, compromise of time over a long period of time. For someone to do a patch cut harvest on their entire RMZ, depending on the length that they have, could take 100 years, 150 years. Anyway, that's kind of the core concept. In your packet, just to help folks get a little better handle on who smalls are and where they are, I think there's the two graphs here are pretty representative of who smalls are. And the top graph there shows that there's 85,000 small forest landowners out there with 5 acres or more that own 10 acres or less. The next bar shows 20,000 of them that own somewhere between 10 acres and 20 acres. And if you look at the red line that's associated with those numbers, if you say the 20-acre bar and you went up to the red dot above that and then look off to the right, you'd see roughly 80% of the small forest landowners own 20 acres or less. You get up to 40 acres, you know, the percentage is, I forget now, I think it's around 90%, but the bottom line is a vast majority of small forest landowners own 40 acres or less. And that's, Evan, this all comes from the Rural Technology Institute. So by definition, from our viewpoint, and from a site-specific basis, the bulk of the small forest landowners qualify for what we would term low impact, just by the size of their ownership. A more appropriate graph to look at relative to forest and fish is the bottom chart, which looks at ownership by stream reach. And again, a similar conclusion, although I will admit that first bar on the left, that's about 110,000 folks, that includes those that do not have any water. But still, the vast majority of small forest landowners own 1,000 feet or less of stream reach. So that's helped you kind of get the context of who we are on the landscape and where we're at. In the template we've tried to do at a site-specific basis prescriptions that will retain the low impact or no impact on a site-specific basis. But if you take some other numbers that are available on the website, you will find that only 18% of the fish water stream reach is owned by smalls. So if you just took a conservative number of a harvest rotation of 50 years, which would be low for us on the west side, especially short for the east side. Divide 50 years into 18%, you're down to about a third of a percent of, that could potentially or would most likely be harvested in a year or that could use this template. There's restrictions in the template that limit the amount of stream reach, so that third of a percent would get down to a fraction of a percent on an annual basis. And from our viewpoint, they're really not cumulative more than, you know, 5, 10, 15 years, whatever it takes to regenerate. So Steve Bernath taught me a big word about 7 or 8 years ago. It's called de minimis. Finally pronounce it. From our viewpoint and our intent in the template was to be de minimis. So then I'd like to go to our Appendix A, and I'm not going to go through all this. I'm just going to hit some of the high spots, perhaps only because Phil and I are kind of proud of what two volunteers created in this Appendix A. It's a lot of science and a lot of language out of the board manual. But the whole intent of Appendix A is to show why, you know, we believe this is a low-risk, low-impact template. And the validity of these comments are really the questions or assertions that the agency folks are now dealing with and having to go through. You know, did they buy into these or don't they buy into these relative to the actual metrics that are in there? So it was our intent to provide low risk, low impacts at the site-specific level. And just quickly, you know, the patch cuts are generally an acre or less. We're still providing a buffer on all fish water and all non-fish perennial water buffered all at the same time, or all of the time. There are some forest health, conifer restoration, things that are partially addressed in the template. Phil will touch on some more of that in a minute. The template versus rule change. The template is a really good vehicle and a safe vehicle to use rather than all the problems that are associated with the rule change. There's just an inherently lower risk to the resource by using a template approach. There are still the possibilities for ID teams. It's easily revisable because it's board manual, not rule change. And it's a process that's part of forest and fish. Also in the Appendix A is a quite a lengthy discussion about the landscape level risks, which I touched upon in the graphics, and I point out the websites that are there. There's just, you can run these statistics thousands of different ways and come up with probably your own graphs. And then the alternate plan guidelines were, and best available science were an important part of our intent when we drafted this template. And in there is a list of citations, thousands of pages of stuff that we believe are all supportive. And we do support another saying, I guess, that I got from Stephen several years ago, is functions are us. And so we tried very hard to address those in Appendix A. I believe that three of them are kind of a non-event. Bank stability, leaf litter, nutrients, sediment filtering should all easily be covered in the template. The two functions that are perhaps problematic for some are the large woody debris and the maintenance of cool water functions. Those are going to be key issues that folks are going to have to work on. Within the template, we do have a strategy for proactively providing all the large woody debris that WDFW could ever want, or DNR. The patch cut metrics are limited to avoid exceeding the Clean Water Act allowances. They're based on past DOE evaluations, and I would point out that three of the folks sitting on the board today were part of an agreement 7 or 8 years ago, 6 or 7 years ago, when we were working on conifer restoration template about metrics that are basically the same as the MATSCA metrics in here. We were working on a different issue than what we are today, but the metrics are the same. And Phil, your turn.
Well, one thing we, on the advisory committee, by the way, there's four people on the landowner caucus, two of us from the east side. So one of the things that we wanted to do with this template is make it a statewide DACA template, so both western and eastern Washington. From the east side perspective, it's important that the template does recognize the importance of eastern Washington small forest landowners by giving them the opportunity to manage all of their forest land, including their RMG forests. And it is essential, we believe, and the template provides that the rules or the template provide incentives for stewardship activities in Eastside RMG forest to remove excessive fuel loads and restoration to early seral habitat types. It's important to recognize that on the east side, the RMC forests are high site ground, our best growing sites. And without the ability to manage those, we're going to lose economic viability for the entire tree farm.
Okay. One other thing in Appendix A that's also a kind of a tough nut that we all talk about is the alternate plan approval standards. And it basically says, it does say, that templates must provide protection for public resources at least equal to overall effectiveness of protection provided in the Act and the rules. And throughout all of our rules, there is a lot of conflicting language, but this rule is intended to be subjective, reasonable person kind of a thing. And most generally, it's looked at in view of the prescriptions in forest and fish, and it doesn't go beyond that. We think the approval standard includes the Act and rules, which Phil just alluded to. So we believe that these RCWs and WACs are empowering and are intended to be part of the approval standard, but they do tend to get overlooked. We believe the legislative intent to SFLOs is very, very clear. To work for SFLOs, a template has to be simple and economically viable.
The advisory committee started this project. However, we believe that if the template were to move forward, if it were to get legs, if you will, we do not want it to be an advisory committee project. A couple reasons. We believe that any unresolved issues, and there will be some, should be addressed at a higher level, somewhere else in forest and fish policy above the advisory committee level. Secondly, I want to change the direction of the advisory committee, change the focus of the advisory committee. I want to raise the stature of the advisory committee within the small forest landowner community and seek their input and feedback regarding any forest practice or stewardship issues that they might have that we can address that they help the Small Forest Landowner Office address through the advisory committee. We think that we can help, the advisory committee can help the Small Forest Landowner more effectively within their current budget and staffing constraints to some of the ongoing projects that they have in dealing with issues such as the strategic plan, goal 3, number item B, in the 2010-2014 strategic plan for DNR. So we think there's other things that the advisory committee can focus on and be more effective with the Small Forest Landowner Office and the family forest community.
And that's not to say that the advisory committee doesn't have a role in consulting, and you know, things still go through there. It's just we need to work on some other things in that committee. So in closing, as the ultimate policymakers on forest practices, we urge you to individually involve yourselves in the ongoing discussions with your constituents to help find a significant tool for smalls that also passes the tests of alternate plans and the empowering RCWs and WACs. We very much want to thank the Forest and Fish Policy leadership and the federal services that have recognized the importance of this last template, and I say last, at least in Phil and I's tenure. We look forward to working with the policy folks and anticipate coming to the very next Forest Practice Board meeting with a template proposal for your consideration. Thank you again for the opportunity, and we'd be delighted to answer any questions that you may have.
Well, before we get to questions, I'd just like to thank both of you for this terrific effort that you have put in to try and find a workable solution for the small forest landowner community. I think we all know that there have been multiple efforts made over time, and that there are current ongoing efforts to address some of the issues that many feel have been unresolved, including FREP, including some of these other issues, including opportunities perhaps around marketing and other issues. So I just want to acknowledge not only your effort, but your understanding about the importance of the forest and fish principles and how widening your dialogue to the other constituencies as you have and as you are currently doing is an essential part of finding a successful path forward to any policy changes that may come before this board. So good work on your behalf, and again, thank you so much. I know there will be questions.
Phil and Ken, thank you very much. Great job. And I know your pay is commensurate with your effort. And,
our pay is commensurate with our results.
I do have one question for both of you. And on your Appendix A, on the first paragraph there, your last bullet, how this template meets the alternate plan approval standards. Okay. My understanding is when these templates first came out, wasn't the idea to take the data from alternate plans and then create templates from that? Wasn't that the original way this was supposed to work? And my question is, what's happened to that concept?
Yes, that was the intent. And I came into it after it had been going for a couple of years. And I suppose if I could get some of my cohorts in the back of the room to sit up here, and we could entertain the hell out of you by describing why the patterns didn't work from alternate plans in the hardwood conversion process. But the conclusion would be there's plenty of blame to go around. I think the last template, the fixed width buffer template, it was really a good thing about simplification. It didn't address what we're talking about here, but it didn't come from patterns. Yeah. So I think that was the original intent. And I think the first template was the overstock stand template, a thinning module. And there had been some alternate plans, but not too many. The big one was the most alternate plans are on the conifer restoration template, and for a variety of reasons, we just could never get there. So, I don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah, we did. Originally, several templates were envisioned in Forest and Fish. You know, we never got there for a variety of reasons, and there's no use rehashing all that. But we felt that even though this doesn't fit a pattern that's out there on the ground right now, we were never going to be able to do that with the template anyway. And this was a much more effective or much more efficient, a simpler way than a rule change. So we decided to structure it as a template rather than a rule change.
And one thing Phil hasn't mentioned here, or I missed in his earlier comments, the templates to date affect west side. They don't touch east side.
We have no temples on the east side.
When we had the forest and fish policy work group, our intent was to go from the west side Overstock Stand template to an east, something comparable on the east side. And we just got hung up on all their health problems, and I've said many times, I don't know why the hell anybody would want to own timber in the east side, but it's just far more common. It just, the complexity is huge. And earlier comments about biofuels and forest health, I think, are going to go a long ways to helping those folks. But this would address, and is east side, west side. It will work for both sides of the state.
Other questions from board members? I want to keep us moving along here, but this is important. Sherry.
I just have a comment. I also would like to thank the two of you. I know you put your heart and soul into this thing. I would encourage the board to take a strong look at it. We've got a couple of guys here that have come to us with solutions instead of more problems. That's very encouraging in my mind.
Yes, Dave.
Thank you, gentlemen, for coming. We've worked together for a long time, and I appreciate your efforts very much. And I'm glad to hear that you spoke about the fact that, you know, it started out kind of in the advisory committee arena, and acknowledge that some of the folks in the state agencies are working really, really hard on a response to this. We take it very seriously, and we want to try to make something work. So we're going to continue to work on that and do as best job as we can to meet your needs, but also protect the resources that we're supposed to protect. So, thanks.
Eager to
go
over. Carol?
So, just to give this some concreteness, are we seriously going to be able to make a deadline for our next meeting where we'll have a full draft ready to review?
Well, I think that really remains to be seen how the discussions go between the different caucuses and these gentlemen.
It would be our hope that we'll have a consensus agreement that we can come back and recommend to the board. If we can't get to consensus, maybe there'll be two or three items, and maybe we can agree to come to the board and ask for board's help on those two or three items I have.
But we'll hear again from you in May.
Yes.
All right. And with that, one last.
So I appreciate hearing a lot that there's good discussions going on with the state caucus. And my question is, are you having fruitful discussions and getting assistance from the conservation caucus and our technical experts? And I see one of them waving his hand back there. I didn't know. There was something we needed them.
No, yeah. I didn't have it because I couldn't hear.
Oh, you couldn't hear. Okay, great.
I didn't hear what you said.
Speak up, everybody.
Yeah. Other than the one meeting that Sherry and I had with you and Chris and I'm embarrassed, Miguel. I forget who else, Miguel was there. And I think there's been a few emails, nothing beyond that. It's my understanding that the state caucus's intent is to, once they've kind of reached some conclusions about it, is to then start involving other stakeholders, hopefully including ourselves at that point.
Yes, that's an accurate portrayal.
All right, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Moving on then to the next item on this morning's agenda, Northern Spotted Owl Implementation Team Update. Bridget, good morning.
Good morning, Commissioner, members of the board, Bridget Moran, Department of Natural Resources. It's a pleasure to be before you today. I find it ironic that the first topic that I am back before the board is one that I had a different responsibility for in my last duties with the board. So with that noted, I'll move on. You have two documents in front of you. One is the draft charter that the board developed for the Northern Spotted Owl Implementation Team, and the second is a draft Spotted Owl Implementation Team work plan. The board directed the implementation team to draft a work plan, and this is our first cut at it. There's each of the items that are in the work plan are those that were part of the recommendations that were forwarded to the team. Rather than go through all of them in the interest of time, I thought I might just highlight a couple of particular items. The team has met a few times since the last board meeting. We have good discussion going on. There's a lot of background work that was done by a few members of the team, or a few of our folks that attend the meetings, and I want to mention how much we appreciate that. Cindy Mitchell and Bettina Von Hagen, who is a member of the team, both spent a considerable amount of time doing research amongst the incentives community across international boundaries to develop sort of a smattering of what different approaches may exist out there for us. So that work was tremendously helpful to the team. So walking through the plan, the first piece is explicitly looking at what type of approach we might use for voluntary incentives, and that will build off of the work, the background work that Bettina and Cindy did. And we're in the process now of identifying who of those particular individuals that that they interviewed might be most informative for us to have follow-up conversation with. And one of them has recently moved to the Pacific Northwest, so that might facilitate that. One point of note, though, is that a lot of the incentives marketplace items that we've seen in the past have been around water issues, so watershed protection, not as much on habitat protection. So we're trying to figure out what can we learn from them that are really relevant. So we have some work to do there. I'm not going to go through a tremendous amount more, but I did want to point out on the bottom of unnumbered page 3 is a statement about the decertification process, and just a note that the conservation advisory group that the board established has not been convened. So I just want to let folks know that's part of my, we have an annual update to let you know if anybody brings a decertification request to this advisory group, that nobody has, but that the membership on that advisory committee needs to be updated. It currently is our members that are either on the board now or are no longer in their positions at DNR. So we'll bring to the next board meeting a recommendation to update that, given that no decertification requests have come forward. We don't feel it's time sensitive. And if for some reason that happens, we have enough time to do that before. There is also a place, the last page talks about convening a technical team to work with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on their modeling efforts that they used for the spotted owl recovery plan. We do expect that the recovery plan will be out in the next few weeks, and some of the modeling information that they use to develop that and they will use for future critical habitat work will be quite informative to us, and we might be able to work with them to see where, to see if we can maybe use that modeling kind of at a downscale version for Washington explicitly, to see if there's anything that that may tell us as well. So we look forward to doing that. Just a reminder that the group is bringing the work plan to the board because we're the board's team, so we'll be looking for any feedback from board members. Maybe they can do that in by the next meeting. That would be helpful. A prime issue, though, just for the implementation team is the fact that there is no staff for the implementation team. I'm the one and only DNR representative on that, and maybe it's not obvious to you, but it's obvious to me that I'm not really able to both do all of the necessary in-between work, which is really about something that Sean brings forward quite a bit, which is we need somebody who wakes up every day thinking about how to move the marble on incentives for spotted owls. And so we're looking at a number of different creative solutions. There are a possibility of linking with the 2541 legislation that was passed last session on incentives. There's an opportunity there possibly with work with the Northwest Environmental Forum. There's possibly a nexus there. However, we're concerned that we don't want the spotted owl issue to sort of get buried in the topics, and that's typically what we've seen before when incentives at a larger scale are discussed. We're also thinking about bringing on an intern at DNR, something we've done quite creatively over the last couple of years in our downward budget exercises to help do some of the day-to-day work. And then finally, we have an opportunity possibly to bring on a UW graduate student who has an interest in ecosystem markets to possibly help work with the committee's work. So I think that we have some opportunity to solve a particular problem to really put some effort into this work. And with that, I will answer any questions.
Questions? Yes, Paul?
On the work plan, I noticed that there's a topic of approved measures of success.
Yes.
And I just wanted to encourage the implementation team to take that seriously, I think, as a board, knowing the extent to which these incentive mechanisms and other efforts are producing results is helpful. And so based on that they can be quantitative and, you know, based on best available science, I would find that quite helpful.
Yes, thank you. The measures of success are something that were a little hastily done when they were originally passed to the team, and so that might be something that we bring back to provide actual specificity what the metrics are, because I think they're a little vague as far as something we could actually report on, but appreciate that, and that's something that we know is before us.
Yes, Dave? Just a quick comment. this is more for kind of an educational purpose, because we're kind of linked to the Bardal Working Group and all of those federal efforts, I wanted to take this chance to tell the board that, if you may have noticed in the last couple of days, I think it was yesterday, it was a big day for some newspaper articles on Bardal removal experiments that the feds are contemplating. And I talked with our staff, who actually sits on that working group. And I just want to let you know that the numbers that are reported in the media papers are out of place and out of context, and that because the EIS has not been completed yet, there are no numbers. And so I think it's just a caution. Wait for the EIS to come out to take a look at all the different scenarios that are going to be presented, all the alternatives that are going to be presented in the EIS, which I think is going to be coming out, I'm not sure exactly when, but probably relatively soon. But I just want to clarify that those numbers should be taken for verbatim in terms of cost and number of hours.
The last item, the implementation team wishes to thank David Whipple for actually starting the initial draft of this, which got the conversation very focused down to what our deliverables are. So we appreciate your effort there.
Yes, Mark.
Bridger, what do you anticipate the Spotted implementation team will do once you receive the draft or final or whatever it is, the federal recovery plan? But yeah, what review or recommendation or process will you undertake once you receive that as part of your work?
Our understanding is that the plan will be released in its final format here very shortly. I think, as Sean mentioned earlier, the implementation team's charter directs us to work exclusively on incentives. I note that the charter is still in draft form and that it expires December of 2010. So that might be something that the board wishes to update, and in so doing may choose some other topics to include in that.
Well, I do know that one of your items was at least the technical team. It's very last page of
the technical team would use the results of the modeling. The idea with that is to possibly think of where we would focus our incentives to try to get the best bang for the buck as informed by the recovery plan.
Spatial description, right?
Yes. The way the modeling is going right on now, it's range wide for the OWL. And so their assumptions and boundaries obviously cross state lines. And so while that may be helpful, and we'll see what that looks like in the final plan, it might be more helpful to us to downscale that for Washington only, because once you model at a larger scale, obviously you lose the resolution that's going to give you the benefits of different actions on the landscape in different areas. So I think that will inform us as to where we would go next.
Paul?
So given the somewhat different tasks that the implementation team is charged mostly with looking at incentives, but there is this technical team that could help answer the questions, and the fact that we anticipate both the final recovery plan and the new modeling results to come out relatively soon. I would like to renew my request that we get U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to give us a briefing, and then possibly if the technical team has had a chance to do some work between now and the next board meeting, that we get some of those briefings, and then we might then be better informed on whether or not we need to either update this charter, or I know that in the past there's been a model of there being subcommittees of the board that work on some of these issues. So if there's both a capacity issue or the sense that there needs to be a higher level of attention paid to some issues depending on what the recovery plan says, we might take that tack instead.
So I can see the opportunity for, if there is a final plan adopted, that it would be appropriate for U.S. Fish to give the board an update on what the implications are for grants within the state of Washington. So that's probably a good suggestion.
And we did have Ken Berg scheduled to be here should the plan have been released, but it has not been. So they're willing and ready to do that as soon as the plan is released.
Probably more than willing.
More than willing.
All right. Thank you very much, Bridget. Appreciate the update. And then I'm going to push forward and ask Aaron to give us a brief legislative update, please.
It's now good afternoon. Mr. Chair, Darren Kramer, Forest Practices Division Manager. This is your regular February ledge update, and I'm going to try to shorthand it so we can get to a lunch break. The sheet that you got this morning was purple spell that you get this morning, so I'm trying to keep track of things and present them to you in as up-to-date a fashion as possible. However, the status of bills was from last week, and some of them probably have changed already. Probably not to a great degree. Again, this is simply a listing of bills that the program has taken a look at that have either an indirect or direct effect on the program. And I'm going to focus on the direct, and that, in our eyes, is something that would require us, or require you to get involved. A change to the Forest Practices Act, CEPA, or the rules themselves that would require some action on the part of the board. Indirect effects are changes to practices, procedures, or something I've included this time around affects our workload, which is something that I'm a little bit sensitive to these days. In summary, since last Thursday, the program had analyzed 53 bills, 23 of which have some sort of effect, 10 of which have a direct effect. That was last week. I'm not sure what the count is up to today. It's probably only a couple more added. That includes 13 fiscal notes as of last Thursday. I was thinking this was probably is a high water mark for the program at this point in the legislative session, but was disappointed to find out this morning that we're in second place in the department behind aquatics, who has looked at some 85 or 5 bills. So we've got a ways to go to catch up. So moving on here on page 1 toward the bottom, the first one I'm going to focus on, HB 1157 and SB 5158. This is a bill focusing on the forest practices permitting system, and it's basically a proposal to extend the time period for improved FPA from 2 to 5 years, with an opportunity to extend that another 5 years if harvest operations are incomplete. Next one down, HB 1161. This is the first of two bills on the sheet that affect FRET. And this is, there's changes listed that focus on eligibility, compensation, and the time the easement is to commence. The next one down on page 2, HB 1162, this is an act relating to streamlining natural resource agencies and is somewhat similar to one we saw last session. This one, in a brief fashion, basically sends the agencies to their corners and says, do your work, consult with each other, but don't try to overlap in your authorities. That's basically what this long list of bullets says, and I'm not going to go through each one of them, but that's basically the overall intent of the bill. Going to page 3, about the middle of the page, HB 1192. This is WFFA legislation, ensuring the viability of small forest landowners. And this is a focus on the existing 20-acre exempt rule and basically expands that rule, tweaks it in a couple of different ways, and it opens it up to all small forest landowners who meet the current small forest landowner definition. HB 1233, another streamlining bill. This is streamlining state environmental permitting through the elimination of the HBA program. Pretty self-explanatory there. Going over to page 4, on the page, HB 1509 and SB 5551. Another bill concerning threat. This is the department's legislation that was spoken of earlier. Again, focusing on some minor amendments to eligibility, compensation, and the date that easement commences. Moving over to page 5, second one listed. Another HBA bill is HB 1588 and SB 5529. This is DFW's HBA legislation, instituting classes of HBAs, fees associated with those classes, and exempting certain activities from fees, in particular FFFP projects, restoration projects. It also moves some items out of the HPA umbrella and into the forest practices arena. At the bottom of the page, SB 5051. This is concerning public notice of proposed settlements of appeals. And this basically requires, would require agencies, when working on a settlement, to make those publicly available, solicit for comments. If a number of comments are received, actually hold public hearings and respond to those comments before proceeding to settlement.
Gary?
Yes.
Clarifying question. Is that the legal settlement?
Yes. Yes. Appeal of an enforcement action, basically, and if the parties decide to go to settlement instead, becomes a public process. Page 6, first one listed, SB 5211 and HB 1582. This is an act relating to forest practices application that lead to conversions. This is a repeat bill from, I think, the last couple of sessions, and this is the attempt to remove the lands platted language from the Forest Practices Act, which has become problematic over the years, and tries to simplify and clarify who's in charge when there's a conversion, and puts an acreage criteria in effect rather than this notion of lands being platted after January 1, 1960. At the bottom of the page, HB 1713. This is a bill relating to the categorical exemptions for SEPA, and basically expands the existing categorical exemptions in a variety of ways, depending on the circumstance, depending if you're a planning county or not, depending on whether there's a critical area ordinance in effect or not, and would require us to update our CEPA references in 7609. That's the extent of the direct effect bills. There's lots of others, obviously, that have more of an indirect effect. And we'll keep watching and update this at the next board meeting. Let you know what really happened. Any questions?
All right. Well, thank you very much. I hope you can use this as a resource for your own use. Thank you very much, Karen. So we're just a little bit late now for our noon break. So let's reconvene nonetheless at 1 o'clock sharp today. Thank you very much. We're recessed for lunch.